Today's episode of the Axon Creative Podcast is brought to you by FreshBooks. To see how FreshBooks can save you time and boost your creativity, go to freshbooks.com/accidental and enter accidental creative in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Hey everyone, welcome to the Axon Creative Podcast. My name is Todd Henry. I am your host. I'm also the author of The Accidental Creative, Die Empty, Louder Than Words, and the new book Herding Tigers, which is about how to lead creative people well. You know, when we hear the stories of entrepreneurs, especially when they're in written form, like in books, we often hear the backward sanitized version, right? Or we often hear platitudes. We hear them talking about big principles, big ideas, things that we've heard a million times, things that aren't necessarily always helpful for those of us who are in the trenches, who are really trying to build something of meaning, but we really don't know how to take the next step. Well, I recently met someone who has not only been successful in her own right as an entrepreneur, but she is teaching other people how to follow in her footsteps. But she's doing it in a very practical, very authentic, transparent way. And I was just blown away by a talk I heard her recently give. And I think her book, Beginner's Pluck, is one of the best books that I've read in a very, very long time. Her name is Liz Forkin Bohannon. She's the author of Beginner's Pluck, Build Your Life of Purpose and Impact Now. And on today's episode, we're going to talk about some kind of counterintuitive principles that she believes are essential for those of us who want to build a life of purpose and impact, especially if we're trying to build our own business. But this is relevant to anybody working in any kind of an organization, doing any kind of work, or just building a life in general. This is going to be relevant advice for you. So I can't wait for our conversation with Liz Bohannon. It's coming up here in just a minute. Before we dive in, I want to let you know today's episode is brought to you by FreshBooks. So as creative pros, we are in the business of turning clever ideas into customer value. That's what we do. And the thing is, great ideas and great creative work take time. They take energy. This is one of the things I wrote about in Herding Tigers. As leaders, we have to protect the time and energy of our team in order to provide them the space they need to do their best work. Well, we need to do that for ourselves as well. And if you're a freelancer, an entrepreneur, somebody who's running your own business, you have to manage yourself by protecting your time and energy to do that work that is truly valuable, the things you're being paid for. Well, doing things like administrative work, accounting, invoicing, that doesn't necessarily leave you with the time and energy you need to be able to do your best work. And that's where FreshBooks can help. FreshBooks is accounting software designed for creative professionals like you and like me. It's so easy to use that you'll save up to 16 hours a month on time-consuming admin and paperwork, which means you'll have more time to let creativity flourish. FreshBooks is packed with time-saving features, like you can create and send branded invoices in about 30 seconds. It is so easy, so simple, and the invoices look great, and they're so easy to interact with. You can set up ACH and credit card payments right there on your invoices and get paid up to 2 times faster. You can snap photos of your receipts from your phone and make managing expenses a million times faster. So when tax time rolls around, you can export tidy reports for expenses, invoice details, and sales tax to make working with your accountant a breeze, maybe even a pleasure. So allocate more time to creating and more of your energy to doing the work that's providing value for your customers, and let FreshBooks take care of all the boring accounting and bookkeeping for you. Right now, we're offering listeners a 30-day free trial of FreshBooks. No credit card required. All you have to do is go to freshbooks.com/accidental and enter accidental creative in the How Did You Hear About Us section. That's freshbooks.com/accidental and enter accidental creative in the How Did You Hear About Us section. We thank FreshBooks for sponsoring this episode of the Accidental Creative Podcast. Well, it is a joy to have on the show today Liz Forkin Bohannon. Liz is the author of a new book called Beginner's Pluck, Build Your Life of Purpose and Impact Now. She's also the founder of Seiko Designs. This is going to be a fun conversation. Liz, welcome to the Axon Creative Podcast.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
So I'm excited on multiple fronts. First of all, we got to meet in person. We both spoke at the Global Leadership Summit about a month ago as we're recording this. And I've just got to tell you, Liz, I was blown away by your talk. Absolutely blown away. First of all, just by your vulnerability and sharing your story. And, you know, sometimes when people get on big stages like that, they feel like they have to kind of like position themselves and make themselves look like really cool. And like you right out of the gate, you're like, I'm just going to blow all that out of the water and just tell you like the worst moments of my life. Right. which was so great and encouraging. So I'm thrilled to dive into this book. But before we jump into the book, could you just tell us a little bit about you and about Seiko Designs and kind of your background?
Yeah. So as mentioned, my name's Liz Forkin Bohannon, and I am the co-founder and CEO of a socially conscious fashion brand called Seiko Designs. So I moved to Uganda almost a decade ago as a recent college grad without a plan, a job, but I did have this journalism degree and this desire, one, to build relationships and community. I, all through college, had said I was really passionate about issues that was facing women and girls living in extreme poverty and conflict and post-conflict zones, but had this kind of come to Jesus moment where I realized, even though I was intellectually really interested in that, I actually didn't have a single friend that was a girl that grew up in that context. And that made me super uncomfortable. And I was like, okay, if you're going to keep, you know, being quote unquote passionate about this thing, your life needs to reflect it a little bit more. You need a community and you need relationships and you need friendships that are reflective of that. And so I moved to Uganda, quit my first corporate job. As you can imagine, my parents were super excited about that, and moved to Uganda without a job. But I had this journalism degree that I had just earned. And so I just traveled the country asking questions and following leads and building relationships. And long story, kind of long, I met an incredible group of young women who were in between high school and university. They had just graduated from a pretty academically rigorous selective high school program, but they couldn't afford to continue on to college. And in Uganda, there's a 9-month gap between high school and college. Okay. And so all of a sudden, this kind of big meta issue of, you know, women and girls living in extreme poverty became really focused. Like, it's 25 women who could go to college and become leaders in their community, but we need to figure out a way to bridge this gap. And so I started a charity and then, for a variety of reasons, shut it down and became really convinced that we needed to create sustainable, dignified marketplace solutions for some of the world's most interesting problems. And then I started a chicken farm, and then that failed. And then I designed a pair of strappy, funky sandals and kind of figured out how we could make them and cobbled together a very rudimentary supply chain and manufacturing system, and basically promised three young women in Uganda, if they made these sandals for the next 9 months, that they would go to college the next fall, and came back home to the U.S. and started selling sandals, even though I had zero interest in business or fashion. And 10 years later, that's still what we're doing. We've got a staff of about over 60 full-time employees in Uganda. We've created opportunity for over 136 young women to continue on to university through our work-study program in Uganda. And now we have scholarship partners in Ethiopia, and we work with fair trade artisans all across the globe. And then the products are all sold actually here in the U.S. through a network of primarily female social entrepreneurs who are selling the product, sharing the Seiko story, and earning an income for themselves and building their own social businesses. And that is what we're up to.
Okay. All right. On episode 2 of my interview. No, I'm kidding. No, that was amazing. Okay. That was incredible. So I want to go back to those early moments of your journey. And I mean, you know, basically that your story is a story of, well, I tried this and it didn't work. So I tried this and I didn't, but, you know, but there was something driving that in the beginning. And the title of this book is Beginner's Pluck. First of all, I love that title. I love the word pluck. We don't use the word pluck enough.
I'm on like a secret mission with this book to do a lot of things, but one of them, the secret part, is like, I just want to bring pluck back into modern lexicon. It's such a good one.
If you look at Google, you can see like word trends over time. And it'd be funny if pluck all of a sudden like spiked in 2019.
So can I tell you something, Todd? I looked it up before the book got out into the universe and took a screenshot of like, here's where pluck is today, just with the wild hope and dream that like a year or two from now, I can visibly on Google see a spike in the word block.
That's awesome. All right. So let's talk about, you know, because we hear about beginner's luck, right? And you talk about beginner's pluck. Let's talk about that word. What does the word pluck mean?
Yeah, well, we all know the verb pluck, right? So pluck your eyebrows, pluck a chicken, pluck a guitar. But the noun pluck means spirited and determined courage. I love that it also sounds like what it means, right? When you say that someone's like plucky, there's like a vibrancy and a boldness to the word that I just love. But the play on words is actually, there's multiple things that go into it. One is that in my journey of coaching and teaching primarily other women, but entrepreneurs to grow and scale their businesses, something that I noticed specifically that women do, and I will say that the book is not written just for women, and I'm actually really passionate about that and really believe that more men need to be reading books written by women.
I greatly enjoyed it, by the way, just as a, I mean, it felt so relevant to me. It did not feel like you were writing just to women. So
yay, that means a lot. I had a lot of men in my signing line at GLS that were like, I'm buying this book for my wife or my daughter. And to every one of them, I looked them in the eyes and I'm like, great. I hope she loves it. You should read it before you give it to her.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Just because it's written by a woman doesn't mean it's for women exclusively. But that being said, I noticed in a lot of coaching entrepreneurs, specifically women, did do this thing where we would invite women who were crazy successful in their business, just killing the game with sales, with building their teams, and invite them, you know, to a call or to speak on stage. And a lot of times they would start out with this thing where they would say, you know, I think I really just got lucky. And women tend to do that. They tend to attribute their success to external factors, where actually men are more likely to attribute their success to internal, like I got it because I'm awesome. And so from the beginning of our business, we have this rule when anybody teaches, it's like, you cannot use the word luck. It's not attributed to luck, because I'm seeing what you're doing. And that, my friend, is pluck. Like, you're putting yourself out there, you're iterating, you're failing, you're getting back up there, you're setting huge goals, and then you're figuring out how to make them into these digestible, achievable chunks. Like, that is pluck. So a saying at our company has become, who needs luck when you've got pluck, and really valuing this idea of pluck over luck. The next thing is that the concept of beginners pluck is because the whole concept of the book is really reframing how we think about being a beginner, how we think about the stages of learning. I know in my own career, I have just wasted so much time and energy bemoaning that I'm a beginner. I don't have the right connections. I don't have the right degree. I don't have the right experience. So how am I going to be successful? And I had this moment several years ago where my entire world kind of upside down. And I realized, oh my gosh, the reason that you've actually had the success that you had wasn't despite the fact that you were a beginner in all of these areas. It was actually because you were a and really saying like, oh my gosh, this is like it felt like this magic, like discovery. And then wanting to get really intentional, honestly, first for myself, going through and saying like, what were the things that I did in the early days as a beginner, just naturally, because that's what beginners naturally do, that now that I'm 10 years into running this company, you know, that now has investors and we've got employees on 4 continents and all of these things that I've stopped doing that I think are actually harming me and my ability to lead and be creative and take risks. And so the book is really about going through, and I've developed 14 of those principles, that these are the things that I think beginners naturally do better than experts. So if you are a beginner, congratulations, you just have to know that like you've got this magic sauce and kind of own it and be intentional about it. If you're an expert, or if you know, you're on the road to becoming an expert, that's great too. But here's how to intentionally channel that inner beginner and kind of get back to being a really curious, question-asking, iterative, creative leader that I really believe is going to help you become more effective in the long haul.
Channel your inner beginner. I like that. That's a great phrase too. That's right. All of these, all it's like you speak in bumper stickers. I love that. That's crazy.
I love that. That's amazing.
So I want to talk about just a couple of those chapters the first handful of them, because as you said, there are several. But the first thing that really struck out to me is the chapter called Own Your Average. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? It's not. Listen, that's not advice, right? That we hear from people. We tell people, you're so special. You're so unique. There's never been anyone like you. And you're saying, no, you're average. You are, right? It's not exactly what people want to hear, but it's absolutely. So explain this to me.
Yeah, this was by far probably my favorite and absolutely the most intellectually challenging chapter to write, because here I am trying to write this book that inspires and creates freedom and gets people to create. But in order to do that, I felt like I could not authentically do that without laying some groundwork. And the groundwork is the exact opposite of what everyone else is saying and hearing. Yeah. That, like, to your point, you're so special. And the reason it felt so important for me to deal with this right off the bat and to kind of say, like, first principle, it's going to be hard to swallow. You're probably average. Is because I have seen firsthand in myself and then with, you know, thousands of people that I've been coaching to run their own businesses, how this narrative of, like, you are so special, you're smarter than you think you are, and you're, you know, stronger than you know, is actually affecting people. And here's what I've seen, Todd. It either affects people in one of two ways. One, they believe the narrative. They're like, oh my, okay, I'm special. I'm, like, a little bit above average, and I'm smart, and I'm kind of inherently good at everything that I try, and I've got this, like, inherent, you know, talent. And when people believe that, I don't believe it actually empowers them. It actually creates a sense of fear and anxiety. Agreed. And people that believe that they are above average and believe that they're special, that have been told, man, you're just so good at everything that you try, they actually start to act out of fear and anxiety, because yeah. They're like, okay, I'm seen as special. I'm seen as above average. I'm seen as talented and smart. I don't want to do anything that is going to cause me to lose that identity or cause anybody to question this inherent identity that I have. Yeah. So they start only saying yes to stuff that they know they'll succeed at, that they'll excel in. They start playing it really safe. And ultimately, that's the demise of being a creative, of being an innovator, of being a leader, is that you start playing it safe and becoming a lot more concerned with protecting your ego and your image than you do about what you're creating out in the world. So that's if you believe the narrative. If we're doing our job and telling people they're special and they believe us, that's what's happening. On the other side, there are people that just frankly don't believe it and won't ever believe it. They're like, that doesn't resonate with me. I don't think I'm super smart. I don't have a hidden talent. I'm not, like, above average or super gifted. And what it does is it makes those people go, and it seems like being special is really, really important. It seems like I need to believe that I'm special before I can go out and do something really, really special. I'm never really going to believe that. And so I guess I'm left behind. I'm an unspecial, below average person who's going to live an unspecial, below average life. And special must be this requisite. Being extraordinary must be a requisite to living an extraordinary life. And so at the point that you're spewing this narrative and people believing it are kind of screwed, and people that don't believe it are kind of screwed, we got to go, like, whoa, 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 whoa. Maybe we've got the narrative wrong. And the facts are, you know, this is like math, it's statistics. You're probably pretty average. Like, that's how averages work. Like, you might be above average. You might be on that right side tail of the bell curve. But you might be below, but statistically speaking, you're probably somewhere in the middle. And I believe that if we can just get over the, like, inspirational self-help mumbo jumbo that's actually causing people to, like, stay in their heads and psych themselves out, all of that energy, we only have a finite amount of energy, right? Energy can't be created or destroyed. And so if we can just get over it and say, like, okay, probably average, never really going to figure it out. There's no actual bell curve that everyone in the world is measured upon. If I can just stop pontificating about that and comparing myself and figuring out, am I special? Am I not? How am I special? And just say, probably pretty average. Yeah. All of a sudden you have this world of energy that then you can redirect to just creating and doing. When you are not afraid of being seen as average because you were the first to say it, you're like, I'm proudly owning my average. All of a sudden, you are a lot less terrified of trying and failing. You're a lot less scared about putting yourself in the room where you're not the smartest person, where you might look a little bit dumb, where you might be a little bit clueless because you're like, yeah, we've all known all along. I'm not special. I'm average. I'm learning. And so we start to take on new risks. There's a new freedom for exploring and for iteration. And we all know that that's how we create and that's how we innovate is when we have that freedom.
Yeah. And you know, the other thing that did for me, I think, was I believe that we are often terrible judges of our own work, judges of the quality of our own work. And so we're sitting often thinking something, well, that's not exceptional. I'm not going to put that into the world. That's not something that's worth sharing with others. Meanwhile, other people are seeing it saying, that's actually really good. Like, I wish you would. Mm-hmm. But when you own your average, you're like, well, yeah, I'll put it out there. It doesn't matter. Like, it's just probably going to be average. And you put it out and people are like, that's really good, right? And I think that sometimes, like you said, it gives us the freedom to innovate and to explore and to be curious and to ask questions and all those things. But I think also it gives us this, the courage, or not even the courage, just the will to put stuff into the world, because you're like, well, this is probably not going to be that exceptional anyway. So I'll just put it out there and see. And then, you know, sometimes it resonates, right? And you realize, oh, maybe I actually have something to say more than I thought I did.
Absolutely. I love that thought. And then when you get feedback on it, good. You're like, this is awesome. I'm going to keep going. When you get feedback about how it could be better, you're a lot less defensive, right? Because you're like, oh, I didn't put this out there knowing it was perfect, extraordinary work that no one can touch. And it's the gold standard. I put it out there knowing like there's probably work to be done on this thought or this idea. And that's like, now all of a sudden I see feedback as this like gold mine of like, tell me what you think. I can like mine that and for these gold nuggets of like, maybe I could get better here. Maybe I could clarify the messaging here. That's an interesting idea. You also are more okay with saying like, no, thank you. You know, just like, that's actually not my vision. That might be your vision for the work, but that doesn't resonate with my vision for it. And just kind of like de-shaming and like egoing, if that's a word, the whole process. But yeah, I love that takeaway of just like, put it out there. Like what kind of, I think oftentimes, and I talk about this in this chapter, I think oftentimes we get insecurity. This is another hard thing to tell people. They're like, oh, don't say that to me. We get insecurity. People are like, I'm just really insecure about this. And I love digging in and saying like, are you insecure? Or do you actually have kind of this over inflated ego around it? Yes. Like what kind of egomaniac am I that I think that if I put something out into the world, it has to revolutionize the industry. It has to be something that touches like millions and millions of people and everybody has to love it. And it's just like, who do you think you are? Like when you own your average, I think you're a lot more likely to say, it's okay. Like if this positively benefits five people, if there are five people whose lives or whose family or whose businesses are positively impacted by this truth, by this project, by whatever it is, then like job well done. Yes. I'm one person and I helped five other people out. Like that's awesome. Like I don't need to come on to every scene revolutionizing it and being the most excellent, most awesome. And I actually believe that when you have that spirit, you're more likely then to go on to create something that does do that, that resonates with, you know, hundreds of thousands of people and that creates an amazing impact because the spirit that you created it out of was like, you're worth it. You one person who might be impacted by this, I'm writing this for you. And if it's only just for you, then like, my time and energy was worth it.
Completely agree. Okay, so that really leads into the second topic I wanted to talk to you about, which is another one that I think is very counter-cultural advice for people. Let's just face it, all of the stuff in the book is pretty countercultural, like in terms of what we typically hear out there. But you tell people to dream small. Don't dream big, dream small. What do you mean by that?
So I love big dreams. I want to put that out there. And I want to say that there's something really beautiful. I have a whole chapter in my book called Stop, Drop, and Wow. And that's really about creating space for your big dreams and to really like visualize them and dream about them and get excited about them before you kind of come in with the how and figuring that out. The problem is I have met thousands of people. Again, it's really just observing, like leaning in and getting really curious, like, how is this narrative affecting people? And what I have seen is that the dream big narrative that is so ubiquitous in our culture right now is actually creating, again, fear, anxiety, and this analysis paralysis. You either have people that are dreaming these huge dreams, which is awesome, but then they're paralyzed because they have no idea where to start. So they have this like big dream that's occupying all of this emotional energy for days, months, weeks, years, but they don't know how to act on it. And that actually is not a healthy place to be because they're waking up every day and whether or not they recognize it, they're like, partaking in this bummer narrative, which is like, I have this big dream, but I don't have the tools. I don't have the resources. I don't know how to start it. And then every day that they exist, like allowing this dream to occupy brain space, but not doing anything about it, it's really demotivating. And then they usually start to, after so long of saying you want to do something and not doing it, you subconsciously kind of start questioning your own integrity, like your own ability, your own will, your own, you know, capabilities. And that's not healthy. The other thing that people do is they don't have a big dream and then they spend all of their emotional energy like beating themselves up about the fact that they don't have this big dream. It's like, oh, someone's telling me to dream big, but like, how? How do I get the big dream? And it puts us back into this posture, the luck posture of like, I guess I just wait. I wait to get the vision, the dream, have this one conversation that sparks this huge revolutionary big idea. And I have just really come to believe that if you are in a place, if you're already dreaming big dreams, breaking them down into, you know, action plans and steps and iterating and evolving, great. Like, you don't need to dream small. That's fine. Keep dreaming big and making it actionable small steps. But if you are someone who's feeling a little bit stuck, wondering how you get the big dream, wondering if your dream is big enough to even act on it in the first place, the hope of this is to just give people permission to say, like, small dreams matter. And actually, small dreams have a shocking power of catapulting us out of waiting and into creating. Because when you take a big idea and you actually make it as small as it can possibly go, the really interesting thing that you do is you remove all excuses. You get it so small that you're like, the only reason I wouldn't be able to act on this in the next 24 hours is if I just simply don't want to. And at that point, then you have to ask yourself, like, you don't care about this big dream, just admit it and then move on to the next thing. Let's kind of be done with the little charade. The other thing that it does for people that have these small dreams is it just gives them permission to treat them like the sacred, beautiful gifts that they are. And to say, like, you are enough, small dream. I'm going to give you the time and the attention that you actually deserve instead of waiting for you to evolve into this big dream. Because I actually think what happens is that we get a small dream. We act on the small dream. We accomplish something. We learn something. We, even if we make a mistake and we fail, the next time we're like, okay, dreaming just ever so slightly bigger, taking the next step, the next evolution. And that actually creates a momentum that builds the type of people and cultures and habits that actually get us dreaming really big beyond our wildest imagination. But we oftentimes, we can't start there. We got to start like everybody else, small dreams, be faithful to them. And then allow the kind of big dream to morph and innovate and iterate from there.
I love that. I feel like we could do like an entire podcast series with you. We could just do like, you know, a dozen episodes with Liz Forkin Bohannon, right?
I'm here.
This is incredible. So good. Such good stuff. And we, I mean, we've only scratched the surface of the book and we've only talked about like the first couple chapters, but so good. What, you know, people need to read your book, Beginner's Pluck. What next steps or advice do you have for burgeoning pluckies out there? Which, by the way, also, like at the Leadership Summit, I was watching your talk backstage and I was like, she named her tribe Pluckies. That's so amazing. That's so great. Like, are you a plucky? I hope you're a plucky. Are you a plucky? You know, Pluckies okay. Unite. That's so good.
Pluckies unite, plucks fly together. You know, it's so, so fun. And seeing people who are reading the book and now self-identifying as pluckies is like, it just makes me unreasonably happy. It's so, so fun because I do think that that identity of like, I'm a plucky. I go out there, I get it done, I try, I fail. And by the way, I have a community of people supporting me is really fun. Okay, I forget the question that you asked me because I got so excited about pluckies.
What next steps or advice do you have for that person who's out there and they're like, I've kind of got this splinter of an idea in my mind and I want to get moving on it. Like, what do you think they need to do next?
I would, it'll probably depend on what stage they're in. And I really wrote the book, those 14 principles. I don't overtly say this, but they're kind of in order. They're in order of like where you are in the process. So everybody has to start with own your average. I just absolutely believe that that is like a psychological reset that we need to have in order to move forward in a healthy way. Then we start with like dream small, because that is really intended for the person that is feeling super stuck, that feels like they have an idea, but they don't know what their first steps are. And then throughout the book, you'll kind of see that it progresses too. You might be in the stage. There's a chapter called Making and Keeping Your Promises. So that's for the person who's in the stage where it's like, I've been ideating, I've been researching, I've been prototyping, I've been, you know, super curious and asking questions, and I've kind of pivoted and innovated on my idea for a couple times. You're eventually going to reach a place in your journey where it's like, okay, we're done tinkering, folks. We're done tinkering behind the curtain, at least. Like, you got to get your idea out there. You got to, as a mentor of mine, Seth Godin, would say, you got to just like ship it, right? Mm-hmm. Get it out there, start getting feedback, make a freaking promise, tell somebody about it, implicate somebody in your dreams. I give an example of like, I actually write contracts for myself. They're between me, myself, and I. Like, I write a contract, I put it on my wall. So taking promises really seriously. So it really, I think, actually kind of depends on where in the process you are. And I really wrote the book in a way to kind of hopefully help somebody be able to chronologically pin themselves. My hope is that someone reads the book and they're like, okay, that's really helpful. That's really helpful. Yeah, I want to do that better. And then they get to a point in their book that they're like, oh, okay, this is where I am right now. The reader can kind of vision themselves in my narrative of, okay, here's where I was with my idea. And they can say like, I think I'm at this point right now and it's time for me to take the leap, or I need to step back and just start, wow, give myself some time to dream and to wow my idea. I need to get more curious. I need to let go of how I think I'm going to accomplish this and be willing to really totally pivot or like completely break what I thought was the answer and start from scratch and build something with the new information that I have. So that was really the hope, that I can meet people wherever they are kind of in that journey, because what your next step will be, of course, is determined by who you are and where you are and what stage your kind of idea or dream or venture is in.
Yeah. Fantastic. Well, Liz, this has been such an amazing conversation. You've added so much value. Thank you for taking the time to be with us. Where can people go if they want to find out about you or about Seiko Designs and all the things in your world?
Yeah. So my company is called Seiko. It's spelled S-S-E-K-O Designs. And you can find us on the interwebs at seikodesigns.com, on social media at the same name. And then I am over, I'm most active on Instagram, which is, I'm just at Liz Bohannon over there. And then if you want to learn more about the book and upcoming things, we've got a book tour actually that we are launching this month. So we're going to do a 7-8 cities. We'll be in Seattle, Portland, LA, Denver, Kansas City, Austin, Dallas, and Minneapolis. If you're in any of those cities, head over to seikodesigns.com and you can go to the tour page and learn about tour dates. And we would love to see you there.
That is awesome. Well, Liz Forkin Bohannon, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you so much, Todd. Love what you are out and creating in the world, and such an absolute honor and treat to get to be a small part of it today.
Well, thank you. And as always, thank you for listening. If you like this episode, make sure you subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts, or just check us out at accidentalcreative.com/subscribe. Remember, friends, cover bands don't change the world. Don't be a cover band. You need to find your unique voice if you want to thrive. We'll see you next time. Thank you.